introductory chapter, the book of Job. The Lord has ordered to have asked Satan where he's coming from. Satan replied, "I'm coming, going around the world." But I'm not Satan. But if I were asked where I'm coming from, I would have to say that I'm coming from going around the world, wandering up and down over it. I've traveled far. I've visited many distant lands. Here, I've been a stranger very often in a strange land. Now I'm glad to be back home again. One of the rabbis is quoting as having said that travel in heart and clothes and on person and on purse. And I'm now qualified fully to substantiate the statement, especially in regard to the last night. Travel may make a man wise, and certainly makes you worse. I should like to share with you this morning, next Sunday morning, some of my observations and impressions. I find it hard, however, this moment, let me organize these impressions, thus be able to convey them to you compactly, safe and adequately. But it requires a certain amount of time to move into it, but to achieve much in a fairly short time. Requires a certain amount of time to adjust it. Right. We visited exclusively those countries that we have not been before. All of our previous vacations, been in the summertime, we avoided what you might call the hot countries. The countries are extremely hot and comfortable for the staff. This is an ancient land of Greece, India, Far East, Burma, Thailand, South Vietnam, Philippines, Hong Kong, Japan. Lands whose histories and civilizations were not altogether foreign to us, we had never seen with our own eyes. As the rabbi said, Ena Doma Mia Yerigia, hearing. Or reading about something, not at all to be compared. Actually seeing it with your own eyes. But you have read, heard about a country, people, about its way of life, current problems. You sound so much more alive. It is a real to see it. And at the same time, so much less absolutely unqualified. But you see with your own eyes, makes you more reserved in judgment, less dogmatic in your conclusions. You become more sharply aware of of contradictions and the paradoxes that exist in any given situation, of the importance of nuance, shades of difference. It's Israeli, I believe, who said that travel teaches toleration. In the widest sense of this term, toleration, that is true. But yet, of course, opposed to this effect, unhealthy, it goes from land to land, from continent to continent, that is gone from century to century, as far as the cultures and the civilizations of the races in those lands. First impression, a man is searching to navigate the globe for the first time in his life. First impression, of course, that great action. Even traveling is one does today a great planes, yes, first ocean liners. One cannot but be profoundly moved, stirred, and at times actually thinking. But what it sees of nature itself, round the world, by the ineffable glory of it, it unfolds before your eyes, and from land, and unseen, that from the air, the rolling ocean, towering mountain ranges, their eternal snow. Primeval forests, deserts, wilderness, there is no way. The fruitful valley, listening rivers, run to the sea, sometimes followed from the air for hundreds of miles. And the way the sun rises in certain places like a certain revelation, elsewhere set, shows it is golden than it is. When you are a wayfarer on the earth, seeing eyes and an understanding heart, come to understand why our forefathers used to utter the prayer and saw the great phenomena of nature, Baruch Atah Adonai, Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, Jesus is who is. Yeshaha knows the Olamo, in these worlds of God, Moses, Ma. And the second impression is yet concerned not the handiwork of God, the handiwork of man. Second impression, each distinction, estimate of history, shifting record of growth, scale, structure, reflex of the souls of the builders we need. Each city tells a story. Their structures, their palaces, their hovels, their proud monuments, their institutions, their museums, their shrines, their temples. Through town and village, farm, factory, clothes, jurisdiction, peace of life, mankind will go apart. You see before you, as you travel everywhere, both the and the present. In most instances, it is the past which speaks to us. The glories of the land are no longer. The Acropolis at Athens, the temple of Poseidon, the Sun, excavation, Delphi, Corinth. In a country like modern India, where so much of modernization is now going down, what appeals to me most is not the present, the exciting, exceeding life so much, as the past, the glories of the past, the red fort of Delhi, the palace of the great Akbar Duke, the breathless beauty of the Taj Mahal and Agra, built to enshrine the mortal remains of the beloved king, the tomb of Humayun. And so everywhere, you reach out for the past. Beautiful pagodas, glorious Buddhist shrines, Rangoon, Bangkok, Saigon, and the astounding ruins of the temples and palaces, perhaps the greatest in the world, Angkor Wat, Cambodia. Amazing records of the labor and the beauty of man. In the sacred shrines of Nara and Nikko and Yota, Makura, clearly you come to realize that it is not enough. The present is not enough to satisfy the soul of modern man. Come to realize that the greatness of the people lies often in its past rather than in its present. You get a heightened sense of history, of the endless flow of life. You come to realize that the past is not dead, that the present is not the last word. Change, current, lengthy, the of life. 9 kilometers out of Athens, one comes upon a beautiful little church, a convent, a dusty. Originally on this side there stood an ancient Greek temple of Apollo, dedicated to the worship of Greek gods. This temple was destroyed in the 4th century of the Common Era, and a church was built on that site, using the building, the stone of the Greek temple of Apollo. After a time, either through earthquake or fire, this church was destroyed, remained one neglected in the southern ruins. In the 11th century, it was rebuilt and restored. And early in the 13th century, it was ransacked again by the Crusaders. Later on was restored again by the Cistercian monks. Then it deteriorated again for one reason or another. It fell into disuse. And in the 15th century, this place, this site, was occupied by the Mohammedan troops. And the next century he was again reoccupied by the Orthodox Christian Church. And it was abandoned again, partially restored in 1920. And traces of each occupation and of each destruction are here and there discernible in the present subject. We can read more than 2,000 years of history of the flux, change, this little church. Little churches that the pagan, Christian, Islam, Christian again. To a modern man standing in his dome, standing before this monument of mutability and impermanence, becomes very humble indeed. This is what happens to the handiwork of man. We wonder what will happen to him, our handiwork. Take your pride out of life. And the third impression that the traveler gets, he goes from place to place, is an astounding diversity of countries, of races, of cultures, languages, religions, astounding variety of customs and ways of life, food, bread. You think of India, for example, and you think of a country and other people. But India's 360 million population is a veritable racial mosaic. Conspiracies of peoples of different racial origins, an astounding ethnographical museum, if you please, speaking some 180 distinct languages and some 540 dialects, adhering to a bewildering diversity of religions and religious beliefs and practices, from the most primitive to the most advanced, to the most sophisticated theosophy, to the crude worshipper of bloody Kali, sacrifices to Calcutta, the endless streams of mystics and services and yogis, holy men, proud the thanks of the holy gems of God. You find in India men as cultured and as educated and scientifically trained as you'll find anywhere in the world. And alongside of them, cities perhaps on the same street. Think back of them. You'll find Indians, and that's the majority of them, illiterate, superstitious, children of the Dark Ages, unspeakably poor. There are villages where most of the people in India live, beggar all description. They are rude, crude, primitive. This is true of most of the countries in the Far East, where one age jostles another age, as it were, on the sidewalk, on every street. And the contrast is a small upper class of education, culture, of refinement, and of wealth, the contrast between them and the vast masses of their people. 98% of them cut that most sharp, most true. When you come to see with your own eyes, see this world, diversity, sharp distinctions which exist not as between one country and another, but within each country. Come to understand the enormity of the problem which confronts these people as they struggle to the light, which confront their government, which in many instances are not at all stable and secure, which confront their leaders, that all of them being of one mind or of one program. Come to understand the enormity of the problem which confronts them as they try to improve the conditions of their people. Come to realize clearly that this is the work not of one generation, but of two. Perhaps it takes. As we see the diversity, we also come to realize after a while there are certain basic needs that they all share in common, all these people. They need food, raiment, roof over their head. The great city of Bombay, infant in India. You find thousands of people, men, women, and children, sleeping on the sidewalk in all manner of weather, having no home, no roof over their head. Numbers of beggars who run into the millions, who are followed on the streets, Bombay or Calcutta or any of the streets of India, except for the government is determined for the sake of the tourists, good incentive to keep them off. By little children following you in the streets, begging, no papa, no mama, please. When you give something to one, it assists the other to come down. An adult, homeless, refugee. Come to understand the basic needs of these people for food, the elementary needs, raiment, shelter. They need food and hospitals, health programs. They need to learn improved methods of agriculture, of industry. They want these people, most of them. They all love their children. The Far East is a world where children are greatly wanted and tenderly loved. They would like to give these children a better chance of life than they have. That perhaps is a new characteristic, a new feature of the Father. There is still vast resignation and acceptance, but there's already great ferment and upreaching in all those lands for the better of the life. In the main, they have awakened or are awakening the new world. The end of colonialism has thrown the full responsibility upon these peoples themselves, who are as yet unaccustomed to the exacting responsibilities of self-government and the requirements of the people. century or more of domination by foreign empires and peoples, regardless how beneficent those empires and peoples may have been in the name they were not, were predatory and exploiting. A century or two of their domination, whatever good it may have done to these peoples, and in some instances it has done some good, and in other instances not at all. It has denied them what might have been their opportunity for learning self-government during this period, and some peoples of Europe learned self-government. Now beginning to learn the secretly the self-control that is required. Need for subordinating private and individual ambitions to the collective good. So the end of colonialism, and it has pretty well ended. The talk that you hear emanating from the Soviets about colonialism, Western imperialism in that part of the world is more or less dated, antiquated. Then the colonialism has brought in a terrific challenge to the intelligent leaders of these people. They are trying to make do, trying in a real hard, dedicated, self-sacrificing way to make do. These peoples welcome the technical assistance and the guidance of experts which our own country and other countries have given them and are giving them. They're extremely grateful for it. It's not true that they're ungrateful, unappreciative. What we are giving them by way of technical aid and assistance, guidance, experts, agriculture, industrialization, health. They're unwilling, because of this extension of aid, to be forced to take sides in this or that power block. World that they're unwilling to do. I call it intervention. If you're unhappy about it, you might call it ingratitude. But these people are concerned naturally with their own life, improvement of the standard of living of their own people. They don't want war. They don't want to be involved in worldwide political struggles. We want to get out of the dark ages of penury and want and misery and illiteracy and hunger. The overshadowing problem in Asia, my humble judgment, over and above what I have referred to as improving their lot in life, materially, physically, culturally. The overshadowing problem is not the sum of imagined red China. Threat of red China, threat of communism in that part of the world. China is too vast, too big, has too many of its souls and terribly difficult problems. It will happen for generations to come. It interferes very much, but seriously, in the affairs of neighboring people. the overwhelming problem of that part of the world is the population problem. You have a sense of always moving in crowds. Those countries, by and large, are crowded countries. Population, of course, is increasing sharply all over the world, including our own country. I read in a Bangkok newspaper last month, an editorial which read something like this. This is from Thailand. One of the achievements of 1958, which has had less than its proper share of attention, was the addition of 48 million people to the world's population in 1 year. That the world is running out of space for its increasing millions is at least as important as the coming flight of mankind into outer space, and probably much more so. We are not going to be able to run away from the problem. While it took a couple of centuries, from 1700 to 1900, for the world's population to increase from 500 million to 1,250,000,000, by 1950, it has increased to 2,500,000,000, doubling itself, that is the world's population, doubling itself in a mere 50 years. If this rate is continued, there will be 5 billion mouths to feed by the end of this century, and 13 billion by the middle of the next. And in a country like India, with its vast population, India increased its own population between 1931 and 1941, that is in 10 years, by 51 million. It is estimated that China, by the end of this century, in 40 years, China will have 1,000 million people. Now it is questionable whether the economic productivity of a country, like India, like China, like Burma, like these other countries of the Far East, can keep pace with their large population and control over population increase. It's most difficult to exert because of ingrown religious beliefs among those people, their traditional marriage customs. An eminent student of Indian economics wrote recently, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that no matter how productivity is increased, economic organization is improved, public health is promoted, or industrialization progresses, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that the standard of the masses will not and cannot be raised to a satisfactory level until changes have been introduced which will enable the size of the population to be better adjusted to its economic resources. It may well be that all these magnificent efforts on the part of Nehru in India and of other leaders in Burma and Thailand, Vietnam, that they will give, they will under the weight of the explosive increase of population. Came away with this conclusion, which I could like to share with you, among others, which I will share with you next time, speak on the subject. The peoples of the Far East are assuming and will continue to assume a greater and greater role of importance in the affairs of mankind as years go on. They're becoming more articulate. They're coming to realize what they want and are looking for methods how to get it. And that our enlightened self-interest, as well as our traditions of humanity, dictate that we extend help to them in every practical possible. Guide them, friendly. We help them raise their standard of living. Not that they will ultimately or immediately line up with us, but that by so doing we will line up with ourselves, as it were, with the golden rule. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do thy brother wax poor, thou shalt surely help. You get back from that part of the world to the United States of America and stop so important the want over there, the abundance over there, the low standard of living over there, incomfortably higher than the things that we are doing. It's really something that makes anyone wonder why we why we have these regular food, warm clothing, nice homes, food for our children, hot, and every social industry, kind of comfort. Those people have a genius, and they have a handful of rice. And they have to eat rice, die. And you get to feel more than at any time that the duty of privilege is service. But our greatest challenge to us will be blessed by that sense of abundance, liberty, freedom. We share the product of God, what we have, and our experience, and our knowledge, and our treasured mind, and then we are so hungry for the truth. Get a feeling that in spite of the great differences, diversities, basically, we and they, so I am blessed in the Western garb, and they in the Oriental garb, and he and they are needing brothers. But in the long run, our well-being depends upon theirs, too. Our peace depends upon theirs. Our standard of living ultimately depends upon theirs. So much for this morning. see what all the designs, just to see other pieces of what I see. That part of the world, Jewish life in that part of the world, I'm a faith. That's